This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiyis Wuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
And it's going to take at least 6 months before we would be able to be in a position to declaring this outbreak over.
That's Dr. Peter Salaba of the World Health Organization on the ongoing Ebola outbreak in the DRC. Details coming up.
Also today, the U.S. honors the late President George H.W. Bush with a state funeral at the National Cathedral in Washington. And the U.S. is reestablishing a permanent diplomatic presence in Somalia after a 28-year break.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on African News Tonight.
Zimbabwe's ailing economy is taking a toll on a number of companies that have been shutting down or suffering slowdowns. The latest is the closure of the National Foods, the country's biggest flour supplier. That's threatening the prospects of bread availability and prices. Reporter Kuzayis Vinavashi has more from Harare.
Early this week, the National Foods issued a statement signed by its chief executive officer, Mike Lashbrook, advising stakeholders that they will halt operations today because they couldn't access foreign currency to pay their suppliers, who have since stopped supplying them. The National Bakers Association of Zimbabwe president, Ngoni Mazango, said today the government should intervene. However, Tafadzwa Musarara, the chairman of Grain Millers Association of Zimbabwe, says the country has adequate wheat supply.
The milling industry remains firm, committed and ready to supply the market. We have moved from the bread shortage, we're dealing now with the price issues. And we have come up with the recommended wholesale prices, which is the prices that we sell. This is done in the public interest.
Mike Lashbrook responded in writing saying, they are currently in talks with the central bank so they can pay their suppliers and resume operations. Lashbrook says the National Foods caters for 70% of the flour market and quality bread flour requires local wheat to be blended with imported wheat. While bread shortages may seem on the horizon, Lashbrook says it all rests on government's ability to avail foreign currency to pay suppliers. Ngoni Mazango, president of the Bakers Association of Zimbabwe, says it's unfortunate that the National Foods is on the brink of closing. He encouraged stakeholders to work together with government to resolve any pressing issues. Musarara says there is no need for alarm.
There is no need for panic buying. And this is our message to consumers that they should just buy the usual quantities they've been getting. We have a plan in place. The plan is under execution. And we are more than ready to meet the high demand that comes with the festivities.
Questions about the future of the bond notes that the country created are a major issue. They are supposed to be on par with the US dollar, but they bring much less on the black market. The looming closure of National Foods comes just weeks before Zimbabweans celebrate Christmas, when bread and other confectionery products will be in high demand. Mazango says, with Zimbabwe's worsening economy, bread has proven a viable option for family meals during breakfast and lunch. For VOA, this is Kudzai Nawashe from Harare.
The Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo is in its fifth month, with projections by the World Health Organization that it will take at least six more months to bring under control. The location in a conflict zone has complicated the international response and frustrated health workers. More than 20 violent incidents have kept aid agencies off the streets for days, and allowed Ebola to refresh its foothold. A vaccine and new treatment drugs are helping, but so far there have been 453 confirmed and probable cases, including 268 deaths. My colleague Paul Alexander talks with Peter Salama, WHO's Deputy Director General of Emergency Preparedness and Response, about the challenges.
Paul, this is perhaps the most complex context for an Ebola outbreak that we've ever experienced. In that light, the outbreak is still ongoing. The first wave, which is really in the north of North Kivu province, an area called the Grand Nord, is largely under control around Mangina and Mabalako. Where now the focus of the epicenter of the outbreak and the focus of the response is very much Beni and a city that's been infected in the last few weeks called Butembo, which has about 1 million people.
So are things getting better or worse or just the same?
It's not a black and white answer. Whereas the outbreak tends now to be moving quite steadily in a south direction. The areas in the north more under control, but the ones in the south, the outbreak still has a number of hotspots that are yet to be fully controlled. And it's going to take at least 6 months before we would be able to be in a position to declaring this outbreak over.
So how have your operations been affected by the security issues and the periodic attacks on Beni?
The direct effects, of course, are the fact that since the outbreak was declared on August the 1st, there have been more than 20 significant violent incidences, especially in and around Beni. When the communities are attacked or massacred, as they have been on several occasions over the last few months, they respond with days of protest. Sometimes they last for several days. In Beni, for example, the community called a ville morte in French, basically a dead city, literally, and it was basically a lockdown for the whole city, including the Ebola response, for 4 or 5 days. And you see that in the data, Paul. We see that every time we've had a major violent incident, the performance of the contact tracing, the percentage of people that are followed up as they should be on a daily basis, dips quite precipitously. It generally recovers, but it takes a few days to recover back to the 90-95% coverage that we'd like to see. So that's the direct effects, and of course that has a psychological impact on our staff. Just a couple of weeks ago, there was a major attack on Beni, right next to the guest house where our staff are staying, and the staff had their hotel rooms were shot at. There was bullets going through the windows and the walls. An ordnance and a mine landed on the roof of the guest house. We were lucky that it didn't explode. Otherwise, we would have had a lot of injuries and perhaps even fatalities. So we had to evacuate 20 of our staff for psychological first aid a couple of weeks ago. The indirect impact is, of course, that for this population, especially in and around Beni, they've been subject to this kind of violence for years. In fact, in some circumstances, decades. And for them, every time there's an attack, the response from the community is quite literally, look, we are engaging with the Ebola response. We're very supportive of it. But you have to understand, as an international community and as the national authorities, that for us, our physical protection is paramount, and we expect you to do more about that. There's a vicious cycle, Paul, between the insecurity and community mistrust.
Are you still running into that hostility and resistance from local communities, too?
The response to the Ebola program has been very, very positive from the community.
Have you considered broader pullouts or relocating your people to safer location?
Not at present. So far, our colleagues, we don't believe, have been deliberately targeted. They've just been caught in the crossfire.
So would you say that you are optimistic that this will be over in 6 months?
I've said that it's going to take a minimum of 6 months before we can declare this outbreak over. We also are very, very encouraged by the fact that neighboring countries have taken already some very robust steps to be prepared.
That was WHO's Peter Salama speaking to VOA's Paul Alexander.
Well, at this moment, the U.S. honors the late President George H.W. Bush with a state funeral at the National Cathedral in Washington. Bush was the only modern American president who previously served as a diplomat, and his diplomatic background served his policies in Africa. While he is remembered for his humanitarian response to famine in Somalia, when he sent U.S. troops in Operation Restore Hope in 1992, he had a significant impact on political liberation in Kenya and South Africa. Paul Nantulia, a research associate at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, speaks with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawy about U.S.-Africa policy during the Bush administration.
I think it helped a lot because he developed a personal interest in U.S. Diplomacy on the continent. And I think two situations elaborate this and demonstrate it very clearly. The situation in Kenya, the United States was heavily involved in supporting the pro-democracy movement and the pro-reform movement in that country during the regime of President Daniel Arap Moi. And it was a pretty intense time in the country. And under President Bush's personal direction, the ambassadors that he sent on the ground in Nairobi played a hugely important role in supporting that initiative. And that role was very significant because each time the country tried to invoke diplomatic immunity and non-interference in internal affairs, the White House and the State Department came out in full support of the activities that their diplomats were conducting in Kenya in support of democracy activists. So that was one instance in which his diplomatic background played a huge role in the political processes as well as governance on the African continent.
President Bush is remembered by his humanitarian response to famine in Somalia as he sent U.S. troops in Operation Restore Hope in 1992.
Yes.
In your analysis, how successful was that operation?
It was a successful operation. Humanitarian corridors were opened. Humanitarian assistance was able to get into the country from Kenya and other places. The United States forces, the Marines that were deployed as part of this initiative, did not work alone, but they worked in close coordination with forces that had been deployed by other countries, including Australia, Botswana, Ethiopia. The Nigerians also deployed. The British, the Turks were involved in this operation. So it was an extensive operation. The former UN Secretary General at the time, Boutros Ghali, said that it was one of the most successful humanitarian assistance operations that the United Nations conducted. As a matter of fact, the United Nations estimated that at least 100,000 lives were saved through the deployment of this task force that was led by U.S. Marines.
The late president used sanctions to end apartheid in South Africa. How effective was his policy to achieve that noble goal?
I think it was successful. Of course, when it was done, there were elements in the ANC that felt that it was a little premature because, you know, the country had not, you know, there were still lots of outstanding elements that still needed to be negotiated with the Klerk government. But President Bush assessed that the process of dismantling apartheid was irreversible. These are the words that he used. I'm quoting him directly. And it wasn't a unilateral initiative in the sense that he did call and speak to Nelson Mandela, who was leader of the ANC at the time, but he had a personal relationship with Mandela and with a number of individuals in the ANC and had a good sense of what was going on the ground. And the U.S. did play a very, very important role in shepherding those negotiations and ensuring that the transitional administration as well as the constitution-making process succeeded. And so, you know, many South Africans, including many within the ANC, do credit President Bush for the personal relationships that he was able to maintain with the top leadership of the ANC to ensure that the process was steered to a successful conclusion. The other thing that I would say is that in as much as the main sanctions were removed, President Bush insisted on keeping the other sanctions in place. So there was military-to-military cooperation, intelligence coordination, security assistance, and all these other elements. He kept those sanctions in place, you know, using the office of the president as further leverage to push the National Party and the de Klerk government into negotiations.
That was Paul Nantulia at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies speaking with our colleague Muhammad El-Shanawi. George Herbert Walker Bush served as U.S. president from 1989 to 1993 after having served two terms as vice president. He also had been a member of Congress, the chief of the CIA, and World War II fighter pilot. He died on Friday at the age of 94. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehis Wuhib. 20 past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Zimbabwe's ailing economy is taking a toll on a number of companies that have been shutting down or suffering slowdowns. The Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo will take at least 6 months to bring under control. And today, the United States honors the late President George H.W. Bush with a state funeral at the National Cathedral in Washington. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
The U.S. is reestablishing a permanent diplomatic presence in Somalia after a 28-year break, saying recent progress there has raised hopes of advancing stability. The U.S. formally recognized Somalia's new federal government in 2013, but has based its diplomatic outpost at the U.S. Embassy in Nairobi, Kenya. Veteran U.S. diplomat Donald Yamamoto arrived in Mogadishu last month as Washington's ambassador to Somalia. The new mission will not be a full U.S. embassy, and some diplomatic staff are expected to remain stationed in Kenya. The U.S. embassy was closed in January 1991 when warlords overthrew dictator Mohamed Siad Barre and Somalia descended into civil war and anarchy. The World Bank in September approved $80 million in grants to Somalia, the first disbursement to the country in 30 years.
Rwanda's annual Made in Rwanda Expo drew big crowds, but not many shoppers. Many Rwandans say the products made in the country are for foreigners because they are too expensive. Some economic experts say African countries need to do more than urge people to buy domestic goods. They need to make sure African industries meet the purchasing power of Africans. Eugene Wimana has more from Kigali.
Hategekimana Louis left the recent fourth annual Made in Rwanda exhibition with empty hands. With an income of about $35 a month, he says he cannot afford the products that are made in his country. He says they are very expensive. He was looking for shoes, but they are more expensive than the used ones that are imported from other countries. Those products that are made in Rwanda are of good quality, yes, but our purchasing power doesn't allow us to buy them. Amanda Wu, who is from China, doesn't have that problem.
I think it's quite good for me. It's quite good for me. Even I can find many good produce with a good price.
Manufacturers say the cost of raw materials means it's hard to make their products affordable for local customers. Sandrine Umararungu is the assistant director of Impano Sport Limited, a Rwandan sport clothing manufacturer.
Importation of the product, the quality material, flights of taxation of the transport are one of the challenges we face here.
Soraya Kuzialemi, the Rwandan trade minister, says problem is not necessarily price, it is how people think of local goods. She says this exhibition aims first at raising awareness in Rwandans that in Rwanda they are produced good products. People have to change their mindset. Sometimes they keep on saying that price is high without even looking at the quality. So it is a long journey of changing the mindset. We suggest that all public workers must wear Made in Rwanda clothes on every Friday. Teddy Kabiruka is an economist. He says that African nations have to promote large-scale production so that the domestically made products are no longer rare and expensive. And that, he says, means more than just saying, buy African products.
There is a long-term strategy for the country with the different economic development policy, monetary policy, investment policy to attract a different investor, especially foreign investor. There's so much more than one policy to be put in place.
Rwanda has banned imports of used clothes, which are both a popular business in many African countries and a popular source of clothes. Some rights activists say the policy takes the bread of poor to favor the rich, but others say the ban will foster local industry. But as a consequence, the United States has suspended the duty-free import status for Rwandan textiles. The government says since they began the Made in Rwanda campaign in 2015, a total export receipts rose to $944 million last year from $559 million. Imports decreased by 4% to $1.75 billion from $1.85 billion in that same period. Ejen Uwimana for VOA News, Kigali.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Solomon Terawali, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss the role of political parties in Africa. Is there room for opposition political groups? Does the African citizen have a right to form an independent opinion? Those issues and more on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
What's up, Africa? It's Jackson Vunganyi.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Cape Town.
Can I be upfront with you? That's exactly what Nadia and I plan to do every Wednesday at 17:30 UTC. Upfront looks at issues that affect you.
Since the world is moving at a faster rate, they need to have an intelligent computer.
Interesting news.
Canadian man was sentenced for drunk driving after being pulled over in his mother's motorized wheelchair. 35-year-old man was fined and placed on probation.
And of course, music. No clouds in my stones. Entertainment, celebrities, you name it, we'll talk about it.
And of course, we love to hear from you. Send us your thoughts and comments. Our email address is upfront@voanews.com.
So don't forget to check us out every Wednesday at 17:30 UTC on The Voice of America.
Hello, Africa. This is James Butte, host of Voice of America's Daybreak Africa. Join me Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC for the latest in African news, features, and sports. We are also available on the internet at www.voaafrica.com. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show on the Voice of America.
The 2019 Voice of America calendars are in. This year's calendar features a variety of scenic photos that capture the beautiful byways of the United States, including magnificent photos of California's Big Sur Coast Highway, West Virginia's Highland Scenic Highway, and even the Cato All-American Road in Maine. Tune into Border Crossings and call to request a free calendar.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.